Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm John.
And today we have Eduardo with us via Zoom. You're in the central area, Eduardo, is that correct?
Yeah, so I stay in Southern California, but visiting Texas right now.
Well, visiting Texas is good. You may want to
You don't want to stay there?
Stay there permanently. Okay. So you spent how long in the Marine Corps? You're a Marine Corps veteran?
Yeah, Marine Corps veteran. I was in 2010 to 2014.
Okay.
Before.
All right. So tell us how you were. You got in and what was your MOS? And tell us about your time in the service.
Yeah. So, I mean, I joined technically when I was 17. Had to wait till I was 18 and finished high school in 2010. And then I got stationed in 29 Palms, California with the 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, where I was an infantryman. It's funny because when I joined the Marine Corps, I had no idea that the Marine Corps had any other MOSs. You know, I went in there and I was like, I want to join the Marines with the idea that all of the Marine Corps was infantry. So
isn't that what they say? Every Marine's a rifleman, right?
Yeah. Everyone's a rifleman. You know, good one, bad one, whatever. But I mean, yeah, I was with them. I was in 29 Palms the entire time that I was there. And as soon as I got there, you know, as soon as we got off the bus, even before we got into the bus at SOI, you know, School of Infantry, they were like, hey, if you're going to 29 Palms, you're going to Afghanistan. And I was like, all right, here we go. I guess we're doing the thing. You know, that's what I signed up to do. Didn't think it was going to happen that quick. And it's funny, as soon as we got to 29 Palms, like all my seniors were already there. Like it was a weekend. I got there on a Friday. And it's like a horror movie, man. Like literally like a horror movie. It's two buses full of just new Marines, like new machine gunners, mortarmen. You know, we got the whole drop. And my seniors are there. It's like Friday, like 4 or 5 o'clock, you know, we're driving from Southern California to, you know, 29 Palms, you know, by Palm Springs. And the further I'm getting from SoCal into 29 Palms, I'm like, man, this is just looking worse and worse by the minute. I was like, man, like this is my first like couple months, my first year in California, you know, I was like, we're not going towards the direction that I was like accounting for. Like I was like, I don't even know where we are.
You're out going to the ass end of the universe.
Yeah. And we get in through the gate, like, you know, the big boring, like 29 Palms MP gate. And I'm like, this is it. Like I'm staring into nothing, like mirages, you know, like of buildings where things are supposed to be. Like here we are at 29 Palms, the gate in the middle of nowhere. And as soon as we start getting closer to all the barracks, it's like the whole base knew. Like at least our unit knew, but it felt like the whole basement because everybody was on the catwalks, like of the barracks, just drinking beers, like staring at us with that, like, I hate you already. I hate you. And then I'm just staring at like just the whole way, like my stomach feels like I'm gonna throw up, you know, like before a talent show or something.
It sounds like your first day in prison as opposed to your first day in the Marines.
Yeah. And I just keep looking and it's like this one senior, obviously a senior, shirtless, like just drinking a beer, hanging over, hands over the wall, like the barrier in the barracks. And he just points at me I'm like, how does he know I'm looking at him? Right at me. And I'm like, I was like, how does he know? I'm like, it feels like we're making eye contact. Like, he's like, I'm gonna kill you. Like you're mine. And I'm like, man, like, here we go. But yeah, I mean, once I got, that was my first weekend there. So that was interesting. But once we offloaded there was like this 200-pound like sergeant, just the buffest dude you've ever seen. And he's like really nice to us. He's like, yeah, y'all boys ready to go to Afghanistan? Like, you know, we're going to leave in 7 months. Like, he's this like Texas guy, like standard Texas. And we're like, yes, sergeant. He's like, hey, y'all need to keep it down. Like, he's like too cool. We're like, I'm so confused, man. Like, you're the buffest dude I've ever seen in my life. Like, you're a sergeant. Like, you know, I'm used to boot camp sergeants and SOI sergeants. So now, like, my first sergeant out of schooling is this huge dude that's like, hey, I need to be cool. And we're like, I'm so confused. And I'm like,
am I still in the Marines?
Yeah, like, where am I? And he's just like, yeah, so we're going to, he was like, yeah, we're going to go to Afghanistan soon, boys. We're going to go back. And I'm like, back? Like, oh, okay. Like, so obviously they just went. And he's like, and so I keep asking him, he's being really cool about it. And it's all of us. We're all asking him questions, like it's like hang out with sergeant moment before we go to the barracks and, you know, face the rest of our lives. And he's just like, yeah, we just got back from Sangin and, you know, we're going to be going back in exactly about 7 months. He's like, as soon as we get you your gear on Monday, you know, and that's how we talk. He's like, as soon as we get you, like, this is a huge dude. He's like, as soon as we get you your gear, he's like moving his sleeves because they're all tight. Like, you know, we're rolling up our camis still. And he's like, you're going to get your gear. You're going to get your rifle. You know, we're going to do some hikes. Good training. Like, he's like, oh, like enthused about it. I'm like, what? Like, and I'm like, and that's sure shit. That's what happened. I mean, Monday rolled around. We got our gear by Monday. Rifles on Tuesday. We were in our platoons by Wednesday. And we like our first month was like, all right, everybody's going to be a green belt. Like, everybody needs to be a green belt. So to me, I was like, that sounds great. Like, you know, like all these people that have trained me before that are green belts, you know, and black belts, like at boot camp, at SOI. And I'm just thinking, so I'm going to finally learn how to like open a can of like whoop ass, you know, like finally.
From this big old dude.
Yeah. This big old guy that's being really nice to me, but could definitely like kill all of us like at once.
When you're that much of a beast, I guess you don't have to be mean.
No, yeah, <that's> no. and that's how he was always. I mean, his name was like Sergeant Otwell. So if he ever hears this, like, I mean, I'm sure everybody describes him this way. He's like a giant friendly beast. But until it's like range time and like deployment, he like kind of switches gears, obviously. But yeah, two combat deployments out there. I mean, at the first deployment, obviously I was a boot, you know. And when you're in the Marine Corps, I mean, you know, it's you're a boot. There's no way around it. Like, you got to carry the saw, and I carried the saw, so that was tight. Like, that, I don't know if that's Marine Corps wide. But in our unit,
is that similar in the Army that like the boot has to do the shit? I mean, I know boots have to do shit.
Yeah.
You know, regardless, it's a police department, fire department, whatever. But
yeah, I know. We definitely got the shit end of the stick. I don't know if my deployment was a little different, only because we got attached to like ODA groups and some special forces guys. So I don't know. So things were a little different. I think I felt more the run, because I was kind of in your situation too, where I got to my unit and it was like a turnaround of, I think, less than 3 months. We were gone. We were in Afghanistan. So it was quick. It was very, very, very fast.
Yeah, your first jump was like,
I didn't even learn how to air assault before, right, I was air assaulting. Right. Yeah, it was nuts.
Where are we going to learn to air assault, sir?
So yeah, I totally understand what you're saying, but I think the more the brunt of the new guy thing was more in the like barracks atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Rather than actually on deployment, because every once in a while we would get, and I don't know how the Marine Corps works, but do you get new Marines while you're deployed?
You get a few, like, few get trinkled in there.
Like stragglers?
Yeah, like just guys that were like failed SOI or something. Yes. Something weird.
So those guys I felt bad for. Those guys that came while we were already deployed, those guys really got the shit end of the stick. They did everything that we didn't want to do. And yeah, I was still new.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, well, that's literally what happened to us while we were out there. We got those stragglers and even NCOs, and they kind of were just like, you weren't here with us for the workup, so we don't like you.
Like, it's like, you weren't here for the first 2 weeks, and we're on week three. You're a piece of shit.
Right.
Like, I don't respect you.
Our 2 weeks make us so much better than you.
Yeah.
So you did two combat tours. How long was each one? Was it a full year?
No, Marine Corps, I mean, at least while I was there, it was just the 7 months in Afghanistan.
Okay.
But, I mean, in all reality, it's like, it's six, because, I mean, it takes like 3 weeks to acclimatize, and then it takes a week to get out of like the FOBs, like the big bases out there that they have. But, I mean, it is still 7 months, but, you know, 6 months you're actually really, you're operating.
Right.
You're
doing.
Where is for the people that don't know, where is the Sangin Valley in Afghanistan?
So yeah, I mean, it's crazy because I live in like right by Camp Pendleton, so it's funny because it's like common knowledge there. But I mean, I guess it's not because mm-hmm. all the Marines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, if you didn't know where Sangin is, it's on the news. It's usually they just say Helmand Province. Mm-hmm. You know, they say just Afghanistan, Helmand Province. But we refer to it as Sangin and the Green Zone because of the way that it's set up. It hugs, it's a part of Afghanistan, just like a little hub that's green. And it literally, that's what I wanted to mention too, is it looks like, it's like if Mexico and Vietnam had a baby. You know? That's literally like
that
what
sounds
it
pretty.
Like. Yeah. Like it, and it's crazy because I took a couple pictures while I was out there of like sunsets and like the weather changes, and it's nice if you just get rid of all the bad, like all the terrorists.
Right. All the terrorists. Afghanistan would be so great if it weren't for the Taliban.
Yeah, I said the same thing, man. I said the same thing. Like, because I was up in the mountains, and it was beautiful. Lakes, rivers, streams. It was beautiful.
But where's my fishing gear?
Yeah, when you mix in assholes with beautiful, it's not beautiful anymore. So,
well, California's perfect example.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it felt like we were camping sometimes, like on those days where, like, I mean, you wake up for post in the morning, and you're mad. Obviously, you're mad because you're waking up for post. But you walk out there, you know, your little post with your coffee cup and all your gear and your rifle. Like, I'm making it romantic in my head, but I really, when I was there, I was hating it.
Sure.
It's dangerous, but you like watching the sunrises and the sunsets out there, and just the placement overall it's crazy how nice it is. Like it's like camping with terrorists.
So basically it's Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
This lake is beautiful. There's just a fucking serial killer running around killing us all. Oh shit. Well, you know, you two combat tours, I'm sure we tend to romanticize things as the further we get away from them. That's the beauty of forgetfulness, is we forget the bad and we remember the good. But the floor is yours, man. What's your story?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wanted to just, I mean, people understand what Sangin was like a little bit from my perspective, because what that green zone was like, because I know I talked to a lot of younger Marines and people that want to join, and they see my pictures online, or, you know, they saw a picture, they heard another perspective of what it's like to be a Marine in the green zone. Or, you know, the more young Marines I talk to, it's their gunnies now, you know, it's like their higher ranking people that stayed in the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. Is those are the guys that have the stories. Like all the combat vets did their 4, maybe 8, you know, and they're just like, I'm done. Like, I got what I wanted, deployed. Like, I'm done. Like, that's at least my friends. That was their mentality.
Right.
We got to go twice. And then people that were our seniors went 3 times, you know, because they had to go. They went by themselves to do the push. Like, my seniors did that push, like the initial push into Sangin. And so when I talk to a lot of young Marines, they don't know anything about it. You know, they don't have any combat leaders other than their first sergeant who's not going to tell them, you know, what it was like. They're not going to go to the smoke pit and just kick it like their boys.
Right.
Maybe first sergeant will tell them a good story, like in the field or after a hike, if the moment's perfect, which, you know, it's the Marine Corps, never is, you know, like unless you just have an awesome leader who's good at communicating, and, you know, you don't always get that
unicorn. Like,
yeah. Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, kind of like y'all, you know, I get a lot of younger guys that are interested in the Marine Corps, guys who are in the Marine Corps and just don't have any perspective. You know, they kind of lost sight of why they joined, who, because they're, none of their leadership taught, like, remotivates them about what their job really is, at least for infantrymen, you know, because I think like a lot of other young dudes like me literally had no idea what the infantry was, but I wanted to do it because I was like, I want to run around with a gun, like work out in the morning and like have a bad
uniform. You're playing soldier.
Yeah. I was playing soldier. I was like, I get to do it for real. Like, yeah, of course.
Yeah. It's the same thing when you become a cop and you're like, I get to play cops and robbers all the time. Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody goes through it probably. And I've just, the more I share my perspective on just joining, like a lot of guys are like, I'm going to do it. And I know like a lot of young guys that did end up doing it because of our conversation and their research. And recently I've just been getting more active guys. So if there's anything that it'd be cool for me to share just some of my perspectives and experiences, if it helps remotivate them.
Right.
Because combat leaders, you know, they're just like, well, what do you know? Like, you know, in their head, you know, they're just like, yeah, you're my sergeant, but what do you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really critical for them to stay motivated, like to remember that maybe there's not something happening right now. You're not in rotation, but it could, you know, something could always, that's how it's always been, at least. So you should always take your job seriously.
Well, like, the president of the United States just told Iran, fuck around and find out. So, I mean,
things
could kick off anywhere in the world at any time. And that's, you know, I mean, who do you call? You don't call, you fucking call the Marine Corps.
Yeah. And all the infantry guys, basically.
Right. I mean, you guys have, you know, we've talked about this. We've talked to many Marines who were in the MEU, you know, and you're the quick reaction force and stuff like that. You're on a ship for all these months, just kind of, you know, floating around. And then if they say go there and attack, you go there and attack, and that could come anytime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, sir. And it's true, because my first deployment to Sangin, the way that we did it was, we had, you know, we have a whole platoon, you know, the HNS guys that do like all the radio and, you know, the support stuff, first platoon, second platoon, third platoon, and then weapons platoon, which got distributed into every platoon. Like that was standard for us, at least. And so each platoon went to their own section in Sangin. They went to their own patrol base. Cause by the time we got there, I think there had been a few rotations now since my seniors, like two, I guess, about two. And a British rotation had gone in and out as well, or a couple. So textbook Marine Corps, a patrol base is only 24 hours. Like you move in, you kick a door in, you stay there, you do a patrol in the morning, you do a patrol at night, and you leave. But the way our patrol bases for my first deployment in Sangin were set up was we were like already living in mud huts. And engineers had came in and kind of fortified the mud compounds we took over. So each platoon was living in about a football size field of a base with a compound in it, so they could put gear and sleep and put radios in. And the engineers also tried to make those three patrol bases circles or squares, so they could just do four HESCO, like just literally like square bases with HESCOs on each corner to, you know, look outboard for terrorists.
Right.
so that was my setup. You know, it was literally just like first deployment. We had a like a central like location where we worked out of every platoon and every squad, you know. But that's what it was like. You know, we were talking about like staying ready and QRF, like quick reaction is we would go weeks where, like I said, it felt like we were camping because nothing would happen.
Sure.
You know, we'd wake up in the morning, make coffee, do the post rotation. The patrols would go out, find ID components in the ground. You know, basically we were just catering to the local population, like in the beginning, at least. Because they were like, well, you aren't getting shot at. Can you help us? Like, you aren't getting blown up. Can you help us?
Right.
Yeah, can you give us money? Can you give us, you know, can you build us a bridge? Like, we built a bridge for them the first month because nothing happened, you know. Sure. That was like a smooth rotation with the unit that was there. And then all of a sudden, you know, our adjacent units in 3-7, second platoon and third platoon, they start finding IEDs, and we're rolling into month two, just like we're camping, we're just walking around finding IED components, serving the local people.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere, just everybody starts, finding IEDs. Like every day, everybody's finding 8-10 IEDs, every patrol, the morning patrol, the evening patrol. I was actually the first one to get shot at on that deployment on post too. It was like a dream come true for like a new SAW gunner. Cause I'm safe on post. I'm still scared shitless, but I'm on post. I'm safe. Like I'm
pretty
safe.
In theory, right? Yeah.
Yeah. In theory, technically I'm safe. And I'm up there with one of the weapons attachments, the mortarman. And he's like, are we getting shot at? It's been like a month and some change. Everybody else is starting to get some, and we're just like, I thought we were insane. Hoping for the worst. We're young, we're young devil dogs. We don't know what we're asking for yet. And after that moment, everything just switched. The whole battlefield just switched. Like if something didn't happen for 3 days, it meant something was going to happen. Like something was going to somebody was going to engage in a huge firefight. Somebody got hit. We had people get hit by IEDs in that third month. Cause they literally made us complacent. At least, I'm not going to sit here and like trash talk our unit, but we were complacent. My mindset was, I was like, we're here.
Like it happens.
I started working out.
That's the reality.
You have a smooth transition. You have a smooth changeover. You have your first month where you're doing nothing. So you're building a bridge. So you start to think, okay, we're at this level and that's kind of where we're at and I can get used to this. And you do.
Yeah. Yeah. To the point where it was only I didn't work out the first month. Cause the nerves are still there. I'm a young Marine in Afghanistan. This is my first time, but I felt safe having the leadership that I had, knowing that they had just been there like 14 months ago. That second month I really did get complacent. That's the reality. Everybody started going to the gym or, sandbag gym and finding ways to work out. And then that's when everything hit the fan for all the platoons. And because of that, they rotated all of us. They rotated us all from the PBs that were in the patrol bases. Because it was the same thing across the board. Like the other platoons, started working out. They were just at the smoke pit all day. We're like, these are easy patrols. No one's getting hit. Like we're going to make it home. Like easy peasy. And the same thing happened again a little bit, but it was like 1 week on, 1 week off, but every day basically find a bunch of IEDs. Like we were saying in the beginning, that's kind of the message that I'd love for anybody who's thinking about joining or wondering what it's like to be in the Marine Corps in Sangin, what that could look like for somebody. Cause I know my seniors, the stories that they would tell us is as soon as we got off the bird, we were getting shot at. Like I had like my main pack, my kit bag, my, a war bag, my rifle. And we were already getting shot at like running to the ECP, like running to the gate. And it varies, and that's why, the Marine Corps is right. Something that they hammer on all the time is complacency kills. And I'm sure it's the same for y'all. Like in y'all's line of work is once you're complacent, you get in this like autopilot mode. That's when bad things happen because you're allowing them to happen. You're just coasting. You're on autopilot.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's where the be polite, be professional and have a plan to kill everyone you meet comes from. Because if you get complacent, if for the police officers who haven't served in the military, it's approaching a traffic stop and making an assumption one time, one wrong time, and the guy comes out with a gun and blasts you. You do it over and over, anything becomes routine.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I mean, that was the biggest, that's why, I mean, people were, I mean, we had guys that hit IEDs, in other platoons and even in our platoon. It was, sadly, it was our EOD tech because it was just like a crazy IED. It was just like an old IED that was just going to go off no matter what, because it was just that janky. But yeah, there's moments that you know, when you're patrolling and saying, and you start getting, you know, you start getting like a little cocky because you're like, all right, as long as I'm jumping in canals, like I'm safe. As long as I'm like, cause I mean, obviously everybody hasn't been there, but like I said, it's like Mexico and Vietnam. Like there was moments out there where we were like walking with like our rifles over our head. And it felt cool. You know, I'm not going to lie. Like, it felt cool. I was like, somebody take a picture. You know, like.
I've seen this in movies.
Yeah. Like, I saw this in Saving Private Ryan or, you know, whatever.
Right.
But it's cool. Yeah. I mean, speaking of that, too, it's crazy. It's like, and it's like, I always tell people, too, they're like, what was Afghanistan like? And I tell them it was kind of fun. But those are the things that I think of. Like those little moments, just hanging with like going on patrol when nothing crazy is happening, hanging in the hooches, smoke pits, looking cool, like being cool.
Right. Well, that's you sit there and you know, I mean, you and I have talked about this a bunch of times though, is you start to really kind of enjoy, even though you're in this weird, fucked up combat situation. Or even though you're in the middle of, you know, putting out a fire, or you're doing what you love, you're doing what you signed up for. It's not like, you know, it's not like you were drafted.
No.
You know, plus when you're with a unit with a bunch of guys that are cohesive and you guys are doing it all together, I mean, that makes it 10 times more fun. I mean, I look back on a lot of things now, like, wow, that was fucking stupid. Like that. Why did I think at the time that was fun? I'm not really sure, but as a group, it probably made it fun. And plus, honestly, I'm a firm believer in your brain does a lot of amazing things without you even knowing about it. And right. I do believe, you know, your brain in a combat situation is making it, in quotes, fun, because there's no other way around it. You're going to do it and it could get really shitty. And there were times that were really shitty. And then there's other times, like you said, where, you know, you get cocky. Like, you know, you're just like, fuck, I'm getting shot at, but fuck it. Let's shoot back over here and then go over here and then shoot back over here. And then, you know, I get it. But that also could be a young and dumb thing, too.
It's partially a young and dumb thing, but it's, I think it's also a coping mechanism to, you know, like you were talking about, your brain does things. But also, for any listeners who have ever experienced this, there is an element, I think, to dangerous professions, which is, now that I know I'm gonna live through it, let's do it again.
Oh yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, I mean, why do you think we like roller coasters, and why do you think we like, you know, water parks and cliff diving and all these crazy things? Because it's the getting close to death and not dying, right? Mm-hmm. What was it? We had the Vietnam chopper pilot on, and he says, I'm not going to apologize for it. And I'll say it. People don't understand the feeling you get when somebody's trying to kill you and they fail and you get them first, you know, and how, despite the fact that you're killing another human being, it's combat, it's fighting, but at the same time, it's exhilarating and you get this weird thrill out of it that you can't explain to people. And if you try, they look at you like you're an alien or a serial killer. I think.
Yeah.
I mean, when I tell people, I tell people, you know, when I was a cop, I chased bad guys and I got in fights and I took people to jail for free. They just paid me to do all the paperwork.
Yeah.
You know, That's what you do. If you could go back for a day and just experience all the fun and know you weren't going to die, you totally would.
Oh, it'd be worse. It'd be worse. Like you said, you're like, let's do it again. What else can we get away with?
Yeah. Exactly. But it's unavoidable. And I think you're right, John. I think it's our brains just coping and adjusting, because the same way you get complacent where you're like, this is life now, this is my life now, you know, then when it's the switch flips and people are trying to kill you, you go, okay, this is my life now.
Yeah, pretty much.
This is the new normal. It's like the people that are wearing masks still in the COVID era. This is my life now. So now you did two tours. Was there a big difference in the two, as far as like, was one crazier than the other, or was your mind, how was your mindset? You know, what was the difference for you in going the first time, you know, and not knowing what to expect, and then going the second time where you have, you know, experience?
They were extremely, extremely different. Something you just reminded me of was like, you're chasing people, you know, as an officer, like you're literally chasing the bad guy. You reminded me of a story where we would, cause the ROEs got pretty bad at a certain point. And we stopped, like, they just wanted nobody, they just didn't want anybody to get in trouble.
Rules of engagement for the audience.
Yeah, rules of engagement. Yeah. So we weren't just allowed to, you know, run around Vietnam style, just, you know, burning things down. Well, burning things to the ground. We could do that to an extent. But we would change. So the rules of engagement changed, and we could only start shooting at people. Like you could lose pit. Like, you know, you could lose the right to shoot somebody if they dropped their gun behind a building. You know, it's almost as if like, oh, he dropped a gun behind the building. We don't know who he is. He wasn't just shooting at us. Like, that's how they wanted us to behave for a little while.
Right.
And so we were literally like chasing guys who would drop their guns behind a bush, and they would have like floaties and rafts, like no shit, floaties, not even like real flotation devices, like
water wings and shit.
and float like just like a little recliner floaty, and try to float from one end of the Helmand River into the, you know, because the Helmand River is like the huge river there in Afghanistan, and it hugs the green zone, the green part of Afghanistan, and then the complete desert, like what you would imagine Afghanistan looking like if you've never been there. And so they would float from our side, the green zone, to the desert. Cause when they, technically our rules at the time were if they cross the river or they get on the river, we can't engage with them in any way. So there was multiple times where it was like cops and robbers were chasing this guy that just shot us. We're just like, if we catch him, like this guy that's been shooting at us for right. 3 weeks now, like we can throw him in the slammer at least something. If we can't, like, we just can't happen to, you know, hit him, engage him.
Yeah, they drop their gun. You're like, pick that back up.
Like, please pick it up. We're tired of seeing you.
But see, that's also part of it is if they know what the rules of engagement are, they're going to go just far enough. And then as soon as they get their ass in a sling, they're going to, oh, you know, I'm getting in the river. I'm dropping my gun.
It was annoying for a while, for a couple of weeks with that.
Did you get the guy?
He just stopped coming around, I guess. I mean, I guess because they hide in the mountain. They cross, like, we were right by the mountains, you know, in the green zone. So they just literally cross. And while we were there, the intel that we got was there was a lot of contract fighters because there had been a drug bust. So the normal Taliban gang that ran around there wasn't there. It was just like contract Taliban.
Yeah. Apparently. Yeah. Wait. You know, that transition started happening. I was there in 2008.
You're going to have to explain this.
Yeah. And supposedly in, not when I was there, but even before I was there, it was a lot of, and I actually thought when we're talking about foreign fighters, I actually thought it was more of the area of operation I was in. It actually was, I think, a lot of Afghanistan, because I've heard multiple stories. Because I was more on the northeastern part of Afghanistan rather than in the south.
Is this like a Haji Blackwater situation?
Almost, yeah.
Because I remember you had Chechen,
yeah, foreign fighters,
but they're, you know, ideologically the same, and so they're trained military and they come over to fight. I get, but what do you like they're paying, the Taliban's paying people to come to Afghanistan and fight?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what their payment method was. I'm not sure exactly how that was going.
Two goats, go shoot at base.
But I did find it interesting. Most of our engagements were not with the Taliban. They were with foreign fighters coming from other countries, just over the border from Pakistan. And it's funny they bring that up, because I thought that because I was so close to the border, literally sitting on the border of Pakistan at the time, I didn't realize that it had reached that far down. So I just think it's very interesting that you had said that.
Your areas were pretty far apart then.
Yeah.
Like, as far as the distance, can you give a rough estimate about how far where your area was from where his area was? I mean, it was a different time frame, obviously, but
I don't know. What do you think? I was probably like, I was stretched out between like Bermel Valley all the way up to like up in the Corngal.
Oh yeah, I mean it's
far.
Yeah, that's up there. That's different. But I mean, there's like one highway, so it makes sense. There's only one real highway
right.
in Afghanistan, so they just it makes sense for them to at some point get there.
Yeah,
pretty far for them.
I'm gonna look while we're talking. I'm just gonna look.
Yeah, because I find the concept of the Taliban being either so decimated in their numbers that they had to bring in contract fighters, or if they were just ill-equipped and they were, it's kind of like, oh, we have all these poppy fields and we can sell all this opium and we have all this money, but we don't have anybody to fight. So we have more money than we have people. So we'll just, you know, pay other militaries to come do our fighting for us or something. That's fascinating to me that they would be able to pull that off.
Yeah, I don't know, because I would see guys that look like they, I mean, they would say that they were Pakistan, but I also saw like some Somalian kind of looking guys.
Mm-hmm. Really, really like, dark.
Yeah.
Dark and skinny.
And that was weird because they would definitely send intel Somalians to just, at least where I was, like they had to be intel Somalians because they would just come and like look at us and I'd look at them and I'd be like, I've never seen anybody that looks like you here. Like,
you're like, nah, you don't belong.
Like, who is this guy? Like, you know, just watching us, you know, because we can't, technically we can't just give him the boot for being in the vicinity of you know, the HESCO and the C-Wire.
Right. If they're not doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
But it's something, they certainly stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
You know, you're sitting there going, and for those of you who just Google Somalia or Google, you know, Somali people, it's so interesting because for whatever reason, that particular region and those particular people have a very unique, almost, you know, like it's just different. It's like, it's, you know, kind of like when you see, someone from, you know, a certain region and you're like, I know exactly where they're from just based on the way they look. You know, and it's just, it's, I guess it's green hair and, or green eyes and red hair. You're like, oh, Irish.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, it's funny you say that, because when I saw my first Somalian dude like roll up on us, I was like, is that a Somalian? You know, and I brought it back to the COC, like the command center.
Right.
They told me that. They're like, oh yeah, we got some intel about Somalians. We didn't think it was a big deal. I was like, I just saw, like...
Yeah, it's not that big.
Yeah. And if they're not shooting at you, don't worry about it. So, the second time you said... It was the contract fighters, you're saying? A lot of that?
The first time. And it's crazy that you brought up the they would call them freedom fighters, and they just had all these different labels, but they were contract fighters. So, that's who we were... That's why it wasn't so... Like, our deployment was... As far as like engagement, it was just really interesting because there was no stronghold there. It was all contract people, like right. just coming in, messing around. Just they're, I mean, they're probably cheaply paid, so they weren't like, I'm gonna die for this, like this money, you know,
right.
They'd probably be monitored somehow or had to report back that they did something.
It's almost like like the professional protesters you see when they're called to a scene to agitate, you know, and turn a protest into a riot, and then when the shit hits the fan and somebody actually confronts them, they and they take off.
Right.
I don't actually care.
Yeah. This is not my ideology. I was doing this for a ham sandwich.
So to give people a reference, and this is the best reference I can possibly make out of this, as far as distance in between. So like, if we were, let's say you were in California, I would have been in like, give or take, the very east part of Texas, like getting like Louisiana, Mississippi, okay. Alabama area.
Okay.
So it was far.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I wanted to figure out is to, cause you know, you see Afghanistan on a map and most people don't ever take the time to, you know, move it over and see like how big it truly was. So you're a good, you know, 2 or 3 day drive away from
easily,
each other.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
That would make sense because that the fighting was there, but it wasn't, I wouldn't consider it a fighting season. Like, I mean, from what I've had been told about that area, from like the typical traditional fighters that were there, from like my seniors and all the intel briefs that we get going in. It's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy that they would go that far, like all the way to the group. They must've really just not wanted to let that area go.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
It's the mindset is interesting because especially, you know, we know ours, we know what we were thinking, but when you try to dissect what the hell the Taliban's trying to do and what they're trying to figure out, what they're trying to, you know, where do you send the letter asking for contract fighters from Chechnya? You know, who do you reach out to? That's a whole other.
Well, I don't know how it was down where you were at, but I know that, I forgot what they were called, but we had these things where, or really it was one or two of them where it was this very like sophisticated camera that sat way up high in the air on this long pole.
Oh, those, the G-Boss?
Yeah, and
right?
You could see miles away. You could see miles and miles away. And, we would monitor training camps that were in Pakistan. And, you know, so basically they were training, doing their thing, and then at some point facilitate an attack or a movement. And then they would cross over. And then because we were that, like literally we could look, or really we could do missions into Pakistan if we did or wanted to. And, cause at the time we weren't allowed to be in Pakistan. And so, I think that they would do their thing, come in and then go right back sort of thing. So I think they just, it's probably like us, but in that country they had their version of like bases and fobs and things. And then, you know, they just go back.
Yeah. They're like, no, we're going to go home now. They can, it's almost like you could deploy for the day.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? It's funny you say that because my second deployment, that's what it felt like. That's the complacency we had to fight. Because initially we got sent to a base called Shook Vegas. It was, or it was called Shukvani, but it got renamed Shook Vegas.
Okay.
Somebody put like a big, like, Vegas, like if you Google it, Shook Vegas, there's like Brits and like all these different, you know, people. It's like a little like sub community of going to Afghanistan.
That's like, funny.
The base is huge, man. Like the army was there. There was like six Blackhawks there. We had like a real medical tent with like surgeons, like our Navy surgeons and stuff. Like that was our base was the Kazovac. In the middle of nowhere, like, or in the middle of Thangin again.
It's a little tiny city that just popped up. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We got army people, Dutch people, like just Jordanians, like those dudes. Like,
I can imagine like that would be like, you know, if the people of Arizona decided to come fight in California, if God forbid, you know, things go to shit, they'd come over from Arizona, do a little fighting, then go back home.
Yeah, pretty much. That's the best way to do it.
Yeah. Right. Deploy for a couple of days, then go home.
Insert, get out.
That's right. I find it crazy that you could watch a base that many miles away and watch people train up and then be like, okay, well, they trained a bunch of people up, so somebody's day is going to go to shit real soon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. You just know it because you know, okay, they've got a group ready. It's, it's like watching cookies bake and you know when they're done.
Yeah. I mean, to the point where you even know, like you're there for so long. And I'm sure you were in the same boat that you're there for so long and you get shot at small arms, rockets, whatever, but you can tell who's shooting at you. Like what team is now you're engaged with just by the way that they're trying to engage you. You're like, oh man, they sent in their fucking
team.
Yeah, they sent in the B team today, whatever, we're good.
yeah. Well, it's funny because as a senior, that like that's something that I learned from my like seniors like too, and from being there, like we'd get pop shots every day and be like just look around. Yeah, just keep going. Like,
yeah.
They were not like, we know who this is. They don't want
to live. you know what else you do that with? In California, you do that with earthquakes. As it starts, you're like, no, this one's fine.
Yeah, pretty much.
Or then when it starts, like, no, this is a bad, this is, right? You make those assessments real quick. Now, you guys could you tell the difference in, like, you say you could tell the difference in fighting style. Could you also tell the difference in the kind of arms that were being used? So like, you know, you you would know it's small arms fire, it's, you know, like the B team, or is it like, oh shit, those are some heavy weapons, this is varsity?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it was with you. I think, because Helmand, correct me if I'm wrong, because I was never there, but Helmand was more, was flatter, and it was more, I guess, like culottes and things like that, like the like mud huts and things.
Yeah, it was flat and a lot of irrigation. Like they'd plant a lot of corn and poppy. So okay. That it was that and canals and okay. Mud huts.
Okay. So, yeah. So I think probably I would think that the fighting styles were probably different because he's in that type of environment and I'm more in like a mountainous environment. Right.
Okay.
And for me, we didn't get into more of the serious engagements until we were actually doing movements to contact and like actually running missions outside of our operating area, mm-hmm. like right at our operating area. That's where the hellacious fight started. Usually around our area was, you know, short bus guys.
The locals were just, you know.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
But did you, I have a question for you. Did you guys have a lot of engagements with the guys that were just protecting the poppy fields?
So we got there and they had already harvested.
Oh.
And what we got from, because we would walk by and we would see like them all cut, you know, and that's right. The first time I'd ever seen that. That was kind of cool. But their weed fields too were still there, but they don't, you know, for anybody that's ever been there knows that their weed field is just like another, just any other day for them. They don't really care about it.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a lot, the cash value of a poppy crop is a lot different than the cash value of a weed crop. And don't get me wrong. Having a weed field is a moneymaker, but having a poppy field, that's a whole other ball game, man. And it's, in a way, if people don't understand the difference, poppy fields are almost easier because they're flowers and you score the pods, collect the sap, it's not like with a marijuana grow, you have to harvest the buds and you have to dry it out. And this is literally, it gets to a point in its growth cycle. You get a razor blade, you score the pod. And then when the milky sap comes out, you scrape it off. That's it. And then you're done. It's so I can imagine when you have a cash value of opium and heroin and all that versus pot, that they're going to take that a little more serious.
Yeah, that's what I was curious.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy. I feel like it was just, now that we're talking about it, I feel like it really was heavy contractors until at my first appointment, heavy contractors until we started getting into the lefty rightsy switching with the platoon, mm-hmm. because I feel like they knew who our unit was, because we even had a guy that used to be Taliban role that was now a good guy, a freedom fighter for Afghanistan, come up to our gunny and just say to him in broken English, like, I know you, I've shot at you, like, and he's like, oh really? He's like, yeah, about creepy. A year ago, yeah. And he's like, no, I know you. He's like, you were here. Yeah, so that was interesting.
That would be disconcerting, to say the least.
I'd be like, I'm a good guy though now.
Nah, I'd be like, all right, we're about to throw some hands right now.
That's right. Like,
drop plaque, let's go.
So now I find one of the reasons, you know, we got in touch with you is you, or you got in touch with us, I guess. You, after the service, you stayed active, involved in kind of helping your fellow soldiers, but also anybody. You started a company and it's called Brothers in Arms, and it's all about the CBD products now, which you can't swing a dead cat without, you know, hitting a store that sells some form of CBD. You can go to Vons and get CBD now. It's crazy. Which is something that I actually, when I was in NARCS, I was like, you know, the idea of that marijuana has no medical value whatsoever is stupid.
Right.
Obviously, we were just talking about the opium poppies. Mm-hmm. You know, opium poppies are illegal. They're a felony to cultivate. But science has found a way to take the extract from the opium poppy and turn it into medicines that allow us to perform surgery, right? Vicodin and morphine and all these different things that are all derivatives from this plant. So yes, heroin is terrible, but the opium poppy is not terrible in and of itself, and it's kind of the same thing I always said with weed. Okay. Yeah. People, you know, drug cartels and violence get fueled by the sale and the cultivation and sale of marijuana. But at the same time, for it to be classified as a Schedule I drug and they, for them to say there's no medicinal value in it whatsoever, that's ridiculous. And so now I guess CBD is the big, it's an extract that won't get you high. So people feel like, oh, okay, it is good. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your company and how you started it?
Yeah, so Brothers in Arms CBD is something that I've been kind of working at since I got out of the Marine Corps. You know, it's evolved into CBD. You know, when I got out, I didn't know what it was. You know, I didn't use it, but it's just the evolution of where I've been trying to build since 2014. Like everything, like I wanted to, like I was going to start a gym, you know, I started multiple businesses to reach out to veterans. And the thing that ended up making the most sense was this, that just made the most sense to give back to have a chance to give back to people. And I started it after I started really noticing how many like of my brothers I was losing every year. You know, it was always at least, you know, it turned into nobody, like nobody was, you know, committing suicide the first year, the second year. And then the third year was, it seemed like every month somebody that I had directly served with or was my senior Marine's mentor, you know, or somebody that we knew was just in bad shape, you know, or just, you know, completely, you know, lost it, like just to the point where they didn't want to be around. And so when I'd learned about CBD and like, and its benefits on like treating, you know, PTSD, stress, anxiety, and, you know, I have a shitty back, I have shitty knees. Like when I wake up, I sound like a Cheeto.
And, yeah, I sound like a bowl of Rice Krispies.
Yeah, and I would always tell my mom that, but since I've been visiting, she believes me. She's like, "Wow, like, you know, you're you know, almost 30 and she's like, you should not sound like that right now." And yeah. And just with everything that I knew when I was in college, I had so many friends who were just getting doped up, you know, guys that, you know, couldn't focus, couldn't sleep, you know, the PTSD was too much. School in SoCal, so everybody there, you know, at Saddleback College is a veteran. Like, you know, if anybody hears this and they've been there, they'll be like, "Oh yeah, I know Saddleback." like they're like, "Yeah, I went there too." Like, so many of them, man, and it sucked to see them. Just it sucks to see somebody so strung out on pills, and that, you know, they're taking like 5-6 pills, and they're taking, you know, they're taking like Viagra because they're taking so many other pills,
right?
Not because they even need it. It's like, dude, I can't go to sleep, I can't focus, PTSD. Now I even have to take Viagra. Like, it's like they're just getting doped up.
Well, so the big thing with a lot of these doctors that treat PTSD is throw pills at you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, there are pills like you're talking about. They're like, okay, so this is going to improve your anxiety and your depression. However, you're going to get fat and your dick won't work. And yeah. I'm like, how is that going to improve my depression and anxiety? I'm going to be anxious that my dick's not going to work and I'm going to be depressed because I got fat.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the medical stuff, I mean, most of the time you get put on one medication, but then the big pharma knows that one medication leads to another one, to another one.
Well, because you start taking the medication and then you tell the doctor, "Hey, doc, as a result of, you know, I'm experiencing X, Y, and Z now." And the doctor goes, "Oh, well, that's part of the medication. Here, let me give you something for the side effects." And then you're, okay, so now you're taking a pill. Not just for a condition, you're taking a pill for the side effects from a pill for your condition. And you just go down and down and down. And then, God forbid, you try to get off any of that shit.
Yeah.
The rebound. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, it's pretty crazy. So,
yeah. Literally a daisy chain of just pills.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. So you were seeing all this. How did you decide, or how did you figure out that CBD was helpful in that you should start a company like that?
So my business partner was already in cannabis. He was in the technology side of it. And his brother was a Marine, and we became best friends. And he's the one that educated me on it. He was like, "You should try it." You know, he knew me, you know, he knew like I couldn't sleep sometimes and everything hurt. And he was like, you should really try it. Cause at the time I didn't like weed, you know, I didn't like cannabis because it gave me more anxiety.
Right.
And cause he was a big proponent of it. Cause I mean, he worked in cannabis and I just kept telling him no, like, you know, like I know how it makes me feel. And he discovered CBD and he gave it to me. He sent me like a whole, like a care package, like a, you know, like a huge box of like 50 bottles, the creams. And this was before the company. Like these were just like blank bottles of samples.
Right.
He's like, try it out. And from there I was like, you know what? Like, I like it. We should do this. Like we should like start a company and like help do veterans, like give it to veterans. And he was like, dude, he was just like, that's a great idea. Like, I mean, if you really believe that it helped you, you know, he's like, I love veterans. Like, he's like, my brother's a veteran. You're a veteran. A lot of his friends ended up being veterans. And that's just how we took it. We're like, it helped me. It's obviously not the end all be all. Like I had to, you know, work out, drink a little less, you know, like
there's other things that get into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Change my lifestyle too. You know, it's not, and that's why I said, it's not the end all be all. It's a good tool. You know, like I find myself when, you know, when I, cause I, you know, like a lot of dudes that deployed, I can just like snap, something could happen. And it's just, it could be like the last straw, you know, that broke the camel's back. And I'm like, dang, like I want to go just hammer down a whole bottle. And cause of my anxiety is so high and I'm mad. And I just, along with CBD, it's just a tool, you know, right. Take some CBD, go work out, go outside, go on a walk. You know, whatever. It's just, it helps. It's another tool for the toolbox.
I kind of feel like we could do an entire episode just trying to figure out and explain to people what CBD is and does, because people just don't. It's so new.
Yeah, a lot of people aren't educated.
It's trendy. Yeah. Maybe, you know what? We could do that on the locker room.
Yeah.
We could do that on the locker room and just do a whole episode of what the hell is CBD and what. Because I remember, you know, because I've used it. I have bad knee, bad back, bad head, all kinds of things. Yeah. And, I, you know, my mother, she's 72 and my wife has MS and she's used it too for, you know, her stuff. She's like, is that marijuana? It's like, no, that's like asking, you know, somebody taking Vicodin if they're on heroin. I think we could probably just do, would you be willing, because you sound like you know a lot about it, would you be willing to come on and maybe bring your business partner and we can explain what it is on an episode of Locker Room?
Yeah, I'd be happy to bring my business partner down and we break it down. You know, that's something that we've been doing a lot and we want to emphasize on, is just break it down to where people understand why they're taking it or how they can take it.
Right, because there's different form. There's creams and tinctures and gummy bears and
yeah,
all kinds of stuff. You know, you can vape it, you can eat it, you can rub some on your gums. You know,
your pet can take it.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. I got a, you know, almost 10-year-old German Shepherd with bad arthritis and bad hips, and I put some of it on his food, and it seems to help him. So. I'll get back with you after the podcast and we'll try and schedule that, because I think that would be really beneficial. Because I know, you know, people ask all the time things like, oh, well, am I gonna pee dirty, you know, yeah. Shit like that. So that's a really good idea. Why don't just give people the website and figure out where they can get in touch with you,
social media and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so our Instagram for the Brothers in Arm, for Brothers in Arm CBD, is The Brothers, and it's the letter N, Arms. The Brothers N Arms.
Right.
And our website is thebrothersinarmscbd.co.
Yeah, and when you reached out to me, I just Googled Brothers in Arms CBD, and you came right up, so...
It's us in a gun range, so it's not the gun range. Yeah.
Right. If people are shooting, it's not you guys. Yeah, you guys, there's a lot of fitness stuff and a lot of lifestyle stuff, there's a pretty good frequently asked questions section and stuff like that. I'm gonna see if I can get you to send me some samples to try.
Yeah. We'll send both of you. Yeah, we got shirts. We got, you know, if you want a shirt, whatever.
Yeah, for sure. We see about partnering.
We'll just
up
trade and, some stuff.
Yeah, we'll trade.
Yeah.
We'll look at driving some business your way, obviously, because we, you know, if I'm going to buy it, I might as well buy it from a veteran-owned business.
Yeah, and you know, you hit multiple demographics too. It's not just when you open up that door to veterans, you have all these veterans that have gotten out and now are doing other things. So, you know, I know from the law enforcement standpoint, you know, like I said, you don't want to piss hot, you know, and things like that. So, and not just police officers, but I mean, really any profession a veteran gets into, you know.
Yeah, any profession where they drug test you, any, you know, thing where you have to have security clearance, anything where you have to, you know, report a city job, a government job, anything right. like that.
And because we've been in a war for so long, you have a lot of veterans of that have gotten out and are just doing all sorts of different things. So yeah, you're hitting a lot of different people.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, so Facebook, Instagram, you have your own website.
Instagram, and we actually even have a YouTube. So same, the YouTube's loaded up with a lot of, you know, what is CBD? How can I take it? Can I give it to my pets? It's like our FAQ on our website.
Well, I'll put a link. I'll put a link on our website too. And, when I do the, social media stuff for this episode, we'll put a link and tag you in it and stuff like that. Cause I think that's really good. Anything to help reduce the number of veterans destroying themselves, either instantaneously because of depression and killing themselves or slowly over time because of depression and, drinking themselves to death or, you know, just not taking care of themselves. I mean, we've dealt with that, in person and over social media more times than I'd like to think about, helping people. We had a message the other day on Instagram. It was great. It was a guy who just reached out to us, and I'll share it with you guys. Just a brief little war story. He's a state trooper, and, he says, I'm a little bit of a superstitious guy. So this kind of hinked me up is, that he works the 301 freeway. Right. That was the freeway that area that he works. And they had a vehicle versus pedestrian. Of course, you know, vehicle wins. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of the lug nut rule, but all the traffic accident investigators I worked with said the lug nut rule is you count up all of the lug nuts on the vehicle and whichever vehicle has more lug nuts wins. And last time I checked, people didn't have any lug nuts. Mm-hmm. So when it's person versus car always wins. So this guy gets creamed in the southbound lane of the 301 freeway. And when they're picking up his body, he has a tattoo that says 301 South.
Oh, weird.
So he had that and he goes, that just happened to me last night on shift. And it just creeped me out a little bit. And I didn't know who else to share it with, but I knew you guys would understand.
Oh, that's weird. That's crazy.
I said, we absolutely do. That shit is hinky.
Yeah, that's weird.
So. Anyway, we'll promote it on our social media, and we'll see if we can't, you know, help each other out. You know, promote the podcast, and we'll promote the business, and we'll cross-moginate. Other than that, do you have anything, John?
No.
All right. I appreciate you coming on with us, Eduardo. Yeah, it was really cool.
I appreciate it. It's cool to hang out with y'all a little bit, do a podcast.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've met so many different people that are, you know, they're strangers when they start the conversation because we're all on the same side and we all have the same shared experiences. It creates this mindset that, you know, you can't explain to other people unless they just hear it, you know, unless they just experience it. So, we appreciate you coming on. We still have, hats available. We have very few people yet. Go in for the contest. I think it's because we just announced it, so we're waiting. We're running a contest right now, giveaway. That you know, post a picture, tag us in it, and the hashtag now I think should be FAFO. Fuck around and find out. So somebody said that's a better hashtag. FAFO. So we're taking their advice. It's hashtag FAFO, and then tag at War Stories Official and in your post, and have our logo somewhere in the post, and we'll pick the best picture, and we'll send you some free giveaway shit from Grey Ghost Gear, and like I said, we got a nice little tactical knife from I think it's Kershaw?
Yes, Kershaw.
Yeah, Kershaw knife and some Grey Ghost Gear stuff and some Warstar stuff. Other than that, that's all I got. If you don't have anything,
good to go,
Eduardo. We try to dedicate our episodes to brothers and sisters who've fallen before us, and we usually give our guests the opportunity to dedicate it to someone if they want to. So do you have anybody you want to dedicate your episode to?
Yeah, definitely Staff Sergeant Joe Augustine and Chris Singer. Awesome dudes that were on my first deployment, you know, our combat engineer and our EOD guy. You know, everybody knew him, everybody loved him, kept us safe, and we're just super grateful to have known them.
Yeah, they paid the ultimate sacrifice, so rest easy, brothers, we got it from here. And until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.